insofar as the moral question of the use of contraception in marriage is still very much a pastoral concern, and insofar as the larger ecclesiological issues raised when one rejects church teaching in a defined area of morality like this remain, it's important for us to learn John Paul II's style of apologetics, not only to help couples learn the why behind the what of the church's teaching, but help all Catholics rediscover a respect for church teaching that will make it easier to give the religious submission of mind and will to God's speaking through the church. So let's get to the ethical problem of Humanae Vitae. He begins immediately with the connection between Humanae Vitae and the language of the body, which we spoke about this morning, saying, "These reflections would be incomplete without a concrete application in the sphere of marital and familial morality. We will reread Humanae Vitae in light of these reflections and illustrate and examine one of its passages." Again, using that technique of the rereading, now that new data have been given, we're able to learn more of what was already there, but we just couldn't see. It says, Humanae Vitae 11 notes that in any use of marriage, there must be no impairment of its natural capacity to procreate. Humanae Vitae 12 adds that there's an inseparable connection established by God between the unitive and the procreative meanings inherent to the marital act. We know that. He said, this passage is central, and it's connected to the sacramental sign. The sign is based on the language of the body reread in truth, in which spouses commit themselves to be faithful, to love and honor each other all their days, not just at their wedding, but throughout their marriage. Humanae Vitae focuses on the moment in which spouses become one flesh. This is the moment when the language of the body must be reread in truth, which is indispensable for their acting in truth. In order for them to be acting in truth, they must read the language of the body built into the other. I've already anticipated that. The paternal meaning of his masculinity, maternal meaning of her femininity, can't be acting in truth if that's being rejected in the very act at the most supreme moment in which those parts of their identity are meant to be expressed by God. Paragraph 12 in Humanae Vitae founds this inseparable connection between love and life in the fundamental structure of the marital act, in the laws written in the man's and woman's nature for the generation of new life, because we're dealing with a norm of the natural law. Humanae Vitae points us to the nature of the act, and then to the nature of the subjects performing that act. The nature of the act establishes the foundation for an adequate reading of these two meanings that must influence the conscience of the acting parties and the relationship between the two meanings. And what's the linchpin of Humanae Vitae? It's this. The marriage act simultaneously, very important word, unites husband and wife in closest intimacy and makes them capable of generating new life. That at the very same instant that husband and wife become one flesh, they're capable of generating new life. These two built-in meanings to the persons who are married, as well as to what they're doing when they're married, must be read simultaneously. When they're separated temporally, we get things like, I eventually want to have kids, just not right now. This is the language of the body in truth, he says, that gives rise to the moral norm. It's a rereading of the ontological truth of the conjugal act, which then enters into the subjective and psychological dimension of the agents and influences their moral choices. He said, even though it doesn't appear explicitly in Scripture, the Church's teaching is contained in tradition and is in accord with the sum total of doctrine revealed in the Bible. Not just its essential premises and general character, but the full context we find in speaking of the theology of the body. That is the full context to ground the conclusion of Humanae Vitae. Hence, the moral norm belongs not only to the natural moral law, to the moral order revealed by God, especially in biblical anthropology, which has importance in ethics, Thus, it's reasonable to look at the theology of the body to found the truth of the norms that concern two people becoming one flesh. And that's what he wants to do in his rereading through the theology of the body. He says the whole biblical background, which he had been calling the theology of the body, confirms the truth of the norm and prepares us to consider more deeply the practical and pastoral aspects of the problem. He then gets immediately into the subject of responsible parenthood, which was one of the main sections of Humanae Vitae. He said Paul VI was guided by the integral rather than partial concept of man, and the integral, not partial, concept of conjugal love. What does responsible parenthood involve? He says it involves discovering the biological laws of the human person, but not just stopping there, but the domination of reason and will over innate drives and emotions, and the prudent and generous decision to have a large family, or respecting the moral law to choose to have no more children for an indefinite now. So it involves all of those things. Domination of reason over innate drives and emotions, true respect, reading the biological laws that the Lord has implanted in the human person, male or female, and respecting the moral law and choosing to have or not to have children, whether it's going to be prudent or not to do that under the circumstances. Most people, he was saying, think that responsible parenthood means avoiding another birth. But it really means to increase the family prudently according to the objective moral order instituted by God and interpreted by right conscience. It involves keeping priorities straight toward God, toward themselves, their families, and human society. It's not acting arbitrarily, but according to God's creative intention and his divine plan manifested in the intimate structure of the conjugal act and in the inseparable connection of the two meanings of it. Why is all of that section important? Because for those who are involved in this quite a bit, there's a little bit of an inside baseball game going on with regard to the whole term responsible parenthood or family planning. Many just think, hey, just go for it. Don't even pay attention to any of these types of things. God wants to give you kids, have kids. That's never been the Lord's intention. We're not against the knowledge, but the knowledge has to be the knowledge of the rhythms in the woman, for example. They have to be integrated within one's spiritual relationship with the Lord, within the whole conjugal spirituality. And it means this prudent cooperation with the Lord. Ignorance is never bliss. He then immediately gets into the distinction in Humanae Vitae between periodic continence, which we generally call natural family planning, versus contraception. He says that Humanae Vitae distinguishes between the morally licit and illicit regulation of fertility. It's morally licit to take advantage of recourse to infertile periods if there are reasonable grounds for spacing births arising from the physical or psychological condition of husband or wife or from external circumstances. So he mentions there physical or psychological conditions of husband and wife. There's a footnote in Humanae Vitae, and there's also a footnote in the theology of the body that goes back to allocution of Pope Pius XII to midwives in 1951, which is kind of the classic locus for the grave reasons, the serious reasons, for the use of natural family planning. What are they? The terms are a little bit awkward in some cases, but the insights that they point to are pretty important. First would be eugenic considerations, meaning if there was a 50% chance that you would conceive a child with Huntington's chorea, perfectly moral not to conceive a child in those circumstances. Never a justification to kill a child who's already been conceived, but it would be a sufficient justification, for example. Second criteria would be medical. If the woman quite seriously might risk her life if she conceives another child because of difficulties in her uterus, that would clearly be a sufficient reason to delay another conception indefinitely even. Third would be financial, Pope Paul says. If you really do not have the resources to raise another child, that would be clearly a sufficient justification. And that's always the call and conscience of the couple. It's not the call of the priest. It's different. You know, the church has never really defined what that means. Does that mean that you're going to be able to pay for the child's hospital bill and the mom's hospital bill? Does it mean you're going to be able to buy the food and to be able to house the child back? Or does it really mean that you're going to be able to raise the child through college? You know, which is now, in the United States at least on average, over $250,000. The church doesn't define that. That's up to the couple in that prayerful dialogue with God and conscience to determine whether they have those resources. But finances are one of the grounds. And the fourth, which is the broadest, social reasons. So a couple, for example, could already have several kids, and maybe they're involved in teaching professions or other things else. They're involved in particular church apostolates. And they might just say, not time for another child right now, so that we're able to keep those commitments. That's fine. Others, which were relevant at the time of war and communism, if you're a Vietnamese woman and you're thinking about escaping to try to go on the Sea of Thailand, where you might be there for 6 months or more, it's not a very good thing to be pregnant. You know, wide variety of things that could go into social reasons. But those are the four classic. John Paul II here expands from physical to the psychological. And we will meet a lot of women, frankly, who are just kind of burned out as moms. They've now raised 3 young children and they just need a little bit of a breather. John Paul II would be saying that's possible as a sufficient justification for the use of natural family planning. What comes before, always, is that first command in the Bible, increase and multiply. It's purpose for marriage, which is for the procreation and education of children, together with the sanctification of the spouses. And so there does need to be a sufficient justification for a couple to come and say, we're not going to participate with that first commandment right now because we've got a weightier reason in order to be able to delay temporarily or indefinitely. What's being implied here, and we'll discuss it a little bit later, is that natural family planning is not just a technique. It's got to be a method tied to an ethos, to a morality. If it's just selfishness that you don't want to have kids, but you know you come to health food stores and you like to do everything the natural way, it's still a moral problem, but it's a different problem than contraception. I don't know how great your moral theology training is. Those of you who don't know these distinctions, just pass them on by. But the difference between the selfish use of natural family planning and the use of contraception, the wrong would be of a different order. In the use of contraception, the evil is in what we would call the finis operis, the built-in end of the action itself, whereas in the selfish use of natural family planning, it would be in the finis operantis, in the ulterior intention of the agent. So it's not an intrinsically evil action, but there would be a selfishness on the part of the agent that could render it immoral, in the same way that we could give money to a poor person out of vanity. The action itself wouldn't be wrong by any stretch of imagination in terms of what you're actually doing, but in terms of the overall moral act, it would be. Humanae Vitae says, John Paul II says, that there is an ethical difference, essential ethical difference between contraception and periodic continence. One rightly used is a facility provided by God in nature. The other obstructs the natural development of the generative process.
Have any other resources or any books that would talk about these just reasons for periodic continence? It seems like it's so hard. Like, you're giving great examples, but do you have any other resources?
Not yet.
Okay.
I'll give you something.
Any other books? Other books out there that go and give more examples, pastoral examples? I don't know.
Germaine Grisey gives a lot of examples there. That would be the first place that I'd suggest you turn.
Thank you.
But what we got to note is that John Paul II stresses that Paul VI notes that in each case, couples may have acceptable reasons for intending to avoid children. What drives them toward the use of contraception might be a sufficient reason. But what he stresses is that the means they choose must also be moral. The essence of the Church's doctrine here consists in maintaining the adequate relationship between the domination of nature and the mastery of self, which is indispensable for man. And one of the temptations we always have is to transfer the methods proper to dominating nature to dominating the self. But instead, man who is free needs self-mastery, which is natural and corresponds to his constitution. Let's delve into that. The human body is not merely an organism of sexual reactions, but the means of expressing the entire person through the language of the body that should prophetically express the truth of the sacrament of marriage and the eternal plan of love. Humanae Vitae brings this truth to its logical, moral, practical, and pastoral consequences, he says. But then he goes beyond Humanae Vitae's apologetic, and he gives this. This is really the nucleus of what he says is the essential difference between the two. It says, expressed in body language, the conjugal act signifies not only love, but potential fruitfulness. To try artificially to separate the two is illicit, because both pertain to the intimate truth of the act, and one is activated with and by means of the other. The conjugal act, deprived of the procreative component of its interior truth, ceases at the same time to be an act of love. Such an act involves a bodily union that doesn't correspond to the interior truth and dignity of personal communion. The language doesn't speak the truth of self-mastery, reciprocal gift, and the reciprocal acceptance of the other person. This violation of the interior order of conjugal union and the order of the person is the essential evil of the contraceptive act. Big words there. What's he saying? That in the use of natural family planning, what is happening is you are embracing each other exactly as God made the other, with the paternal meaning of his masculinity, the maternal meaning of her femininity. The use of contraception, it's a condom or a pill, it'll change depending upon whether it's a man or a woman, rather than truly welcoming and embracing the other totally as God made the other, you're rejecting that part of the person most made to flourish in that. So that rather than loving the other, there's a rejection going on at the same time. That's what happens when we see the truth of the other and correspond. But it also means we've got to see the truth of ourselves. And if there's a serious reason for not conceiving a child right now or for the indefinite future, the response to that, because we are moral agents, is to discipline ourselves morally, rather than just think that our bodies are a tool that we just need to sort of take out a component part for the time being. Because that violates our interior culture, who we really are. He calls us to conjugal chastity, which is not just a technique, but an ethos. And he says very clearly that the use of infertile periods can be an abuse if the couple, for unworthy reasons, seeks in this way to avoid having children. The morally correct number of children must take into account not only one's family, the state of health and means of the couple, but also the good of society, the church, and the whole of mankind. It can't just be a self-referential decision. That's one component. But also what the Lord wants is key as well. You know, let's just take the extreme of this. Let's look at France. It's going to be a Muslim country soon, because the average rate of children for a typical Muslim country, a couple in France, is 6.1. And for a French Christian couple, depending upon the region of the country, between 0.7 and 1.1. Several years ago, Vladimir Putin in Russia declared a national holiday. And I won't say the actual expression that he used in Russia, but it was basically F Friday. He wanted everybody to just go home and make babies. And he said it was a matter of national security. Italy, as George Weigel describes very pointedly in The Cube and the Cathedral, Italy, by 2030, is going to be a culture in which 60% of Italians won't have any relative except in the direct line, meaning no cousins, no brothers and sisters. You may still have parents who are alive, you may have a son or a daughter alive, but no cousins, no aunts, no uncles, because of the birth rate in Italy. These are Catholic countries. One of the things we as pastors need to be able to do is to fill people with hope in such a way that we encourage them courageously to embrace life. There may be huge sacrifices there, and we shouldn't minimize it and pretend that it's easy, but the bottom line is one of the real impacts of the consumerist materialism of our culture is that we fear the sacrifices that are required in raising another child. You know, one of the great ways that we do that is to promote and praise the generosity of big families. Rather than cursing anybody or sort of making anybody feel guilty, a lot of the times, if we do it that way, people who are past childbearing age but may have made some bad decisions can be filled with guilt. One of the great things that we can do is we can really praise those heroic families who, in the midst of great difficulty, are doing all that they can to raise up not only their own children, but God's children. He outlines conjugal spirituality, which is a continence and a chastity tied to self-mastery, prudence, justice, fortitude, and charity. Conjugal spirituality. This is not just something in the act of making love that extends throughout their marriage, but it also takes place in the bedroom. That there's continence, that there's that holding of holiness and honor. There's also chastity, it's the reverencing the other in the body, raising one's attraction up to the dignity of the person as a whole, meaning the built-in paternal and maternal meaning. And he says that the piety, love, and chastity mold the couple's spirituality to protect the dignity of the body language of the conjugal act and its procreative potential within God's plan and the other person's dignity. The antithesis of this conjugal spirituality, he says, is the contraceptive practice and mentality which greatly harms man's interior culture. It restricts the mutual freedom of the gift manifested in the nuptial meaning of the body. And part of that conjugal spirituality, he says, is shown in affectionate manifestations that help the other remain faithful and chaste. When a couple can't conceive or through periodic continence, it's very important that they're able to express their love in other chaste ways, what he calls affectionate manifestations, which allow for an interior climate suitable for personal communion in which the interior truth of the language of the body continues to speak love. Conjugal spirituality. The spirituality that undergirds the use of contraception is often harmonious hedonism, a mutual utilitarianism. And once that starts to invade a marriage, rather than making love, they start to corrode the love that's already there. Because the more we use someone we love, the less we grow in love. Let's make some applications. The first is to responsible parenthood as priests. Doesn't mean we're supposed to be having kids. We're called to be open and attentive to a large family, while at the same time seeking to provide well for the overall good of those entrusted to us. There's some planning involved, so that it's not just arbitrary, but intentional. Like with married couples, we want to increase the size of God's family, the size of our parish. And despite our best efforts, sometimes we might not see any fruit. But we should seek to promote the responsible procreation and raising of children in the parish, one aspect. Promoting courage among families, second. Promoting infant baptism and the life of baptism, third. Seeking converts and making the time to prepare them. These are all aspects of our responsible parenthood according to our state of life. In the second conference yesterday morning, we didn't have a chance to ponder the application of the theology of the body to our spiritual fatherhood as priests. Can take it up now briefly. We're called to a real fruitfulness in Christ. Fatherhood, of course, means bringing to birth and educating, raising. Not just raising kids, but raising mature adults. There's a fatherly meaning to the body, because there's a fatherly meaning to man. This needs to be read and reread. It's not really being read in our culture, even sometimes among priests, who, for example, think that women, or those who never aspire to fatherhood because of their sexual attractions, should be able to be ordained. It's an intrinsic spiritual fatherhood to the priesthood. John Paul II says that our continence for the kingdom must lead to spiritual paternity analogous to conjugal love. In his first Holy Thursday letter to priests back in 1979, he described the special link between spiritual paternity and celibacy for the sake of the kingdom. He says, through his celibacy, the priest becomes a man for others in a different way from the man who, by binding himself in conjugal union with a woman, also becomes his husband and father, a man for others, especially in the radius of his own family. The priest, by renouncing the fatherhood proper to married men, seeks another fatherhood, and as it were, even another motherhood, recalling the words of the apostles about the children whom he begets in suffering. We're fathers who go through labor pains, is what he's describing. It's not an effeminate fatherhood. It's a fatherhood that suffers labor pains. In his 1995 Holy Thursday letter, John Paul II said, the priest must exercise toward the men and women to whom he is sent a ministry of authentic spiritual fatherhood which gains him sons and daughters in the Lord. And this fatherhood is an essential part of our priesthood. Most of the time when we think about the fatherhood of the priest, we think about God the Father, and that's all true. Christ came to reveal the Father in the mystery of his love. But Jose Granados wrote a beautiful article a few years back on the spiritual fatherhood of Jesus as the image of the Father. And basically, I'll summarize, he says, Jesus gives us new life. Jesus is a Father through the sacraments, and we minister that new life through our priesthood. Christ's fatherhood, Granados argued, on the basis of various fathers of the Church, Justin Martyr, Melito of Sardis, Irenaeus, and the letter to Dionysius were his sources. Christ's fatherhood is virginal, opening up the ultimate future of life by situating his children in the perspective of the eschaton. The priest, in representing the self-offering of Jesus for the world, enters into this virginal and spiritual paternity. He acts in the person of Christ, the head of the Church, inasmuch as he is the source of divine life in the sacrament, in the order of the community, and in the official proclamation of the word. We go to a seminary to become semen, his own seed. Rather than just planting the seed of the Word of God, Jesus in another place says that we are the seed, first as disciples, but in a special way as priests. He wants to plant us in the field of the world. The priest as father not only receives Jesus' life and gives it to others, something all Christians are called to do, but specifically transmits life with the originality of Jesus himself, the source of grace through his own identification with Christ as head of the church. Granados draws a practical consequence from priest as father, pointing to the fact that the priesthood is vocational, not merely functional. And therefore, it's meant to extend throughout the whole of his life. Understood as fatherhood, the priesthood can't only be an office that the priest carries out during certain hours of the day. Rather, it's a vocation that embraces his whole existence. Fathers are never fathers part-time. They're always dads. I'll have in the notes for you 10 aspects of spiritual fatherhood that Jesus reveals from the Father. I'm not going to go through them all. I'll just mention what they are, all taken straight from sacred scripture. The Father takes delight in his children. This is my Son in whom I'm well pleased. Father loves unconditionally, making his Son rise in the good and the bad. Cares about everyone 100 out of 100. Not the will of my Father that one be lost. Father's generous. Look at the birds of the air. Look at the lilies of the field. The Father always takes care. Father's observant. Sees what's done in secret and rewards. Father's merciful. You see that in the parable of the prodigal son. Father instructs those who are docile. He reveals the mysteries of the kingdom to the childlike. Father disciplines. We see that throughout the Old Testament. We particularly see it in the letter to the Hebrews chapter 12. The Father works and works hard. My Father is working still and I'm working. How important it is for us as priests to be hard workers. Jesus doesn't ask for bodies in the vineyard, but he asks us to pray to the harvest master for laborers in the vineyard. 10th, the Father wants to share his child's life. For this is the will of my Father, that everyone who sees the Son and believes in him should have eternal life, and I'll raise him up on the last day. The image of fatherhood in the priest is always a participatory reflection of the fatherhood from whom every fatherhood takes its name. When Jesus says, call no one on earth your father, he's stressing this precisely to point to the unique way in which we all share in God the Father's paternity, including the spiritual paternity within the church. John Paul II focused on spiritual fatherhood, particularly by linking it to St. Joseph. Some beautiful passages in his 2004 book, Rise, Let Us Be on Our Way. He said, for St. Joseph, life with Jesus was a continuous discovery of his own vocation as a father. He became a father in an extraordinary way without begetting his son in the flesh. Isn't this perhaps an example of the type of fatherhood that's proposed to us, priests and bishops, as a model? And then he says, everything I did in the course of my ministry, I saw as an expression of this kind of fatherhood. Baptizing, hearing confession, celebrating the Eucharist, preaching, admonishing, encouraging. For me, these things were always a living out of that fatherhood. You know, one of the reasons why he was so effective is because he had such a paternal identity. He was a strong father, which he learned, obviously, from his dad, Colonel. Everything I did in the course of my ministry, I saw as an expression of this kind of fatherhood. It was one of the sources of his unbelievable spiritual fertility. There are many defective forms of spiritual fatherhood. What are they? Deadbeat dads who are never around, fulfilling their responsibilities to the son or daughter, or to the bride, the church. Sperm daddies who give the sacraments, but no further pastoral care. Authoritarian fathers who boss, but don't love. Emasculated fathers who are more mom than dad. But there's something far worse than these. It's a type of anti-fatherhood found in what we might call priestly contraception. God calls us to be fruitful and multiply. There's supposed to be a particular spiritual fecundity in a priest, someone who gives life. This happens through a unity with Christ, sponsality, and fatherhood. We've seen this, Father, in the lives of so many saints, St. John Bosco, John Vianney, Francis de Sales, Charles Borromeo, Alphonse Liguori, John Paul II. We've seen it also in many of our brother priests, including probably for most of us, the blessed priests who fathered our own priestly vocation. But many priests spiritually contracept. They don't allow the full power of the Lord's love to flow through them. The reason is because of staurophobia, fear of the cross. For us to bear fruit, Jesus tells us, we must fall to the ground like a grain of wheat and die. Sometimes rather than becoming truly spiritually fruitful by our continual sacrifice for Christ and His people, we can become too comfortable in our own situation. We can stop giving. A few years back, I was down in Sugarland, Texas, preaching a parish mission. There were 11 masses, church fit 800. Every single mass was packed. I was wasted at the end of the weekend, preaching 11 times for a half hour, half of the mass in Spanish. I was dead. The pastor of the parish said, "You need a drink." I said, "Yes, I do." So we were sitting out in his backyard. I said to him, "Bart, this was one of the most unbelievable weekends of my life, just to see so many masses so packed." Bart speaks very slowly, like the Southerners. Takes a long whiff of the cigar he was smoking. Says, "Well, Raj, the truth is, you saw only 20% of the Catholics in Germany. What keeps me up at night are the 80% who aren't coming. If they were all coming, we'd need a church five times as big." I learned a big lesson there. He wasn't complacent of having a thriving parish with a $35,000 a week collection and a brand new school designed by Duncan Stroika. He had a real zeal to welcome his children home. That's spiritual paternity. Like with married couples, there's a unitive and generative meaning to our priestly personality. Both need to be present. We just can't say, "I'll just focus on the unity of the spiritual offering I already have entrusted to me." We need to spur ourselves and them to have our love overflow toward others. Two last points. We can't succumb to the temptation for the domination of nature instead of self-mastery. John Paul II mentioned that one of the fundamental errors in the use of contraception was that it took a technological solution to an ethical problem. Sometimes we can be guilty of the same error in our priestly life. We can participate in one workshop or program after another. We can consult every sociological study, read dozens of articles to address certain of the pastoral and personal issues we face. But these are, in a sense, reifying the problem. Sometimes what's needed most is for us to recognize that the solution is before us. You probably have heard the celebrated response of G.K. Chesterton to a query in the newspaper after World War I, I believe, in Britain, where the question was asked, "What is the biggest problem facing Great Britain after the war?" He won the contest with a one-word answer: "Me." Okay, some of the times we're the problem. I am. Sometimes we just need to humbly see that we're the issue and turn to the Lord in prayer for the solution, to remind Him that He wills the sanctification of our people and that we don't need some guru for much of what troubles us personally and pastorally. We just need Him. Sometimes we need to pray and fast as St. John Vianney did. A priest came to see him once who was struggling in a situation to get his people to respond to all his hard work. John Vianney said, "Have you prayed? Have you fasted? Have you taken the discipline? Have you slept on the floor? Have you made a novena? Unless you've done these things, you have no right to complain." In many cases, the solution for which we're looking is not a technical one, but a personal moral one. Last thing that we learn is about JP2's pedagogy and how it's supposed to impact our own. We see that throughout the theology of the body, He took us to found what we were teaching on the words and the body language of Jesus. We should learn that method and imitate that method. You know, when I was in seminary, I don't know the way it was with you, but the way people were taught to preach is always start with a story.
Sir, we have the gospel. We just kiss the book. We don't need to have a story of a starfish on a beach. Okay?
To learn this method is really important. When we're not good at it, we make lots of methodological errors. One of the big problems with a lot of the interventions of the church in the public sphere is that we're always playing what I call away games. We're just saying, okay, we can't use explicitly biblical terminology in the secular sphere, so let's use the natural law, let's use reason. That's totally fine for that orbit. But most of the time, the way we form our own people is with the same categories. It just doesn't motivate them. For the same reasons why Mana Vitae pastorally failed, even though it was true. In Massachusetts, for example, when I was a baby priest, we had the problem of same-sex marriage being forced on us by the Supreme Judicial Court. Everybody else was talking about the functions of marriage and children and everything else. Just like, let's talk about what Jesus says. Well, what does Jesus say? He said, it's right there in the gospel. In the beginning, God made them not male and male. We're not trying to be polemical, but male and female. For this reason, a man shall leave not his two daddies or two mommies, but his father and mother, and cling not to whomever he's sexually attracted to, but cling to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And that one flesh union doesn't just refer to the ephemeral physical contact in a bedroom. It doesn't merely refer to the union of this particular man and this particular woman in that specific marriage. But it also, in a sense, refers to God's will of the union of man and woman in the institution of marriage. Therefore, what God has joined, man must not put asunder. I asked when I was on a committee, let's just focus group that and see what will motivate the Catholics in the pews. Because in order to win this thing, we don't have to motivate everybody. We just have to motivate a critical mass of people who come to us to go out and become salt, light, and leaven. And when we focus grouped it, it was off the chart that people were far more motivated when they saw how it was connected, specifically what Jesus taught about marriage, than all these other philosophical truths. They were all true, but they didn't have the same inspirational quality. John Paul II gives us a pedagogy that we need to learn and imitate. I want to finish with a meditation on the theology of the body that John Paul II left us as he was preparing to leave us. In it, he tried to inspire us to pick up the baton from him and take it to the next generation, the next level, to pass on as a first importance what we ourselves have first received. He did it in the form of a poem in 2003 called Meditations in the Book of Genesis at the Threshold of the Sistine Chapel. The Sistine Chapel, as you know, features the works of Michelangelo. His account of creation, then Eve, then his depiction of the fall, his recounting of the details of salvation history, and it finishes with his account of the Last Judgment and the passage to the eschaton where there will be no marriage or giving in marriage. John Paul said that the Sistine was the theology of the body in fresco and color, where Michelangelo helped all of us first to see creation and how good and beautiful it is, to reread the book of our origins, going from wonder to wonder. And he said that the message speaks from those walls as it leads us inexorably toward the judgment, till we stand face to face with him who is. And he continued, it's here, at the feet of the marvelous Sistine profusion of color, that the cardinals gather, a community responsible for the legacy of the keys of the kingdom. They come right here. And once more, Michelangelo wraps them in his vision of God the Creator, who turns toward Adam. The Sistine painting will then speak with the word of the Lord to us, Petrus, as Simon the son of Jonah heard, to you I will give the keys of the kingdom. Those to whom the care of the legacy of the keys has been entrusted gather here, allowing themselves to be enfolded by the Sistine's colors, by the vision left to us by Michelangelo. He said it was so in August and then in October of the memorable year of the conclave, and so it will be again whenever the need arises after my death. Michelangelo's vision must speak. The cardinals will find themselves between the beginning and the end, between the day of creation and the day of judgment. and they will receive a final clarity and light. The clarity of the events, clarity of conscience. It's necessary that during the conclave, Michelangelo teach. Precisely, he was praying that Michelangelo would teach the theology of the body and all its beauty. This task, which the 264th Pope entrusted to the cardinals who would select his successor, is also in a sense entrusted to the priests and to all the faithful. We're called to look at the beginning in all its beauty and all its color, and to the end in all its attraction for those who are pure of heart, and not only find the fundamental direction of our life between loving and lusting, between life according to the Spirit and life according to the flesh, but learn how to help the world rediscover the vision of the way things really are. We're now experiencing the first fruits of the harvest of the rich seed of the theology of the body that's been planted in the fields of the world. The vineyard remains ever ripe and white for a harvest. Each of us has a small portion of that vineyard. I'm very honored to be here in the Archdiocese of Vancouver, which is, I believe, the only archdiocese that has dedicated the priest's precious resource of a sparse commodity, a priest full-time, to helping plan and reap those seeds. It's an archdiocese that has had 9 very long lectures in a 2-day period on the theology of the body. But that rich harvest isn't going to be the work of one priest or a team of a few or even lay people and deacons working together with them. It involves all of us. Whether we've started at 5 in the morning or 9 in the evening, we all have an important role to play. Now is the time for us to roll up our sleeves and, moved by the Holy Spirit and helped by the celestial assistance of Blessed John Paul II, to fall in love with human love anew, and to give ourselves totally and unselfishly to the work of redemption through helping people, through human love, receive and reciprocate to the full the love of God. How we try to do that will be the subject of the last talk after the break. Praise be Jesus Christ.